This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. And welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. And I wanted to get back to roots today. The original goal of this podcast, although we may diverge in many different directions, is to celebrate and provide a platform for badass socialist women activists. That's the raison d'etre of this podcast. So today I have got a badass socialist woman activist with me today. Welcome to the show, Haley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you're a new transplant to the great state of the great nation of New Jersey.
Yes, the great nation of New Jersey. Yeah, I've only been in the state for about 3 months. I come all the way from California. Everywhere that I've been in this state, people have always asked me, like, why the hell did I do that? But hey, I'm happy to be here. I actually really like New Jersey. Everybody's been really nice to me, so it's been an easy transition.
And while you were in California, you were a big trans rights activist.
Yes. Yes.
That's something
yes.
you're very passionate about. So can you give me a little bit of background about that?
Yeah. So, in case it wasn't already apparent, I am a trans woman, so I'm 23 years old. I was born and raised in California. My birthday is this month, so it's great.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Over in California, some of the things that I dealt with, especially, like, on an institutional level, where, like, at my university, they didn't have, you know, like, preferred name and gender changes, like, irrespective of legal name and gender changes. And it can be really, like, problematic and cost prohibitive to access the services. Excuse me. So, like, when we talk about getting people to be recognized for who they are, names and pronouns are huge, right? And so, for me, I was getting really tired of being dead-named and everything, like, on attendance sheets and in my documentation and that kind of thing. And even in my email, like, even though I changed my name on my email, it still wouldn't show up.
Can you explain what deadnaming is for anyone that doesn't know?
Yeah, so deadnaming is using the old, unpreferred, non-real name of a trans person.
The name you were assigned at birth.
Right, exactly. So, for me, like, and for several other trans women, being deadnamed, trans people in general, not just trans women, excuse me, being deadnamed is a huge attack. I mean, it sort of seems trivial, like, on the surface, but take it from our perspective. Like, we're trying to be something that we actually always were. And that name serves as a reminder of something we're not. And, you know, it's individually, like, if it happens every now and then, it's not necessarily a big deal, at least for me. But when you start dealing with it systemically, when you confront your dead name in your everyday life, whether it's trying to navigate institutions or access services, get a passport, that kind of thing, these things fundamentally reflect who you are in a legal sense. And as I'm sure everybody knows, like, that's tremendously important. So to put this in perspective, when I went and got my legal name and gender change, I didn't qualify for a low-income fee waiver. And to get everything that you want to get done, it costs about $435 where I'm at in California. Across the state, it's different. Each superior court jurisdiction has its own fee structure. So there's not even a unified fee structure.
Some states may be more or less, depending
absolutely.
On... And,
yeah, and I would
imagine... But $400 is still fairly cost prohibitive for
absolutely.
Somebody that's young or someone that's living in poverty or mm-hmm. not being paid what they're worth.
Yeah, and so for trans women, right, especially trans women, trans men don't necessarily have this problem, but for trans women, the poverty rate is insane. You know, and for me, like, I've especially struggled to find work throughout my history after coming out. You know, I was fortunate enough to work in a Pride Center in my community when I was in college. So I didn't necessarily have to deal with that, but that's not something that I can do forever. You know, it's not a career job. It's not something that's going to necessarily pay, like, a huge living wage over the long term of my life. You know, I need to do certain things. I need to start a career and do things that I want. I shouldn't necessarily have to exist within the confines of a friendly space.
Right. Know? Every space should be friendly. Absolutely. For everyone. Right. It shouldn't just be, oh, this is your little lane, go stay in it.
Exactly. And so, you know, trans women are something like 76% more likely to live under the poverty line. And I think it's like 14 times more likely to make $10,000 or less per year. And because of that, like, trans women are disproportionately, like, forced into sex work. And, you know, sex work is fine, necessarily, like, if you're doing it by choice. If you're doing it by survival, I think that's where we start running into a lot of issues.
Right, survival you sex know? Versus choosing this as a career.
Right, if you choose to do, like, pornography or something like that, like, more power to you. Like, that's on you. You have every right to use whatever it means that you
but
have.
But it shouldn't be your only option.
But it should not have to be your only option. Exactly. I mean, in actually adequate society, like a lot of us pretend America is on in the mainstream media, that kind of thing, you know, these things shouldn't happen. But the reality is that for trans women, in particular trans women of color, the rate of violence that we face and the rate of discrimination that we face is tremendous in comparison with our cisgender counterparts. So for those who aren't aware, cisgender just means people who identity matches the gender that they were assigned at birth. So, for example, if you were assigned male at birth and you live your life as a male and you're comfortable living as a male, then you are a cisgender male. But if you were assigned male at birth but you don't feel comfortable living as a male and you identify as like non-binary or as a female, you know, that makes you transgender. You know, your label as a gender is obviously up to you, but nomenclaturally speaking, you know, trans is just anybody who doesn't identify as the gender that they assigned at birth.
Right, that's good. I think we have listeners from all differing levels of education. Absolutely. About LGBTQ issues, so it's good to get those terms cleared up so we are all speaking the same language.
Absolutely, thank you.
And also, I had heard you speaking at a women's forum that I was mm-hmm. also speaking at, and you made the statement that a trans woman of color on average only makes about 15 cents on the dollar compared to a cis white male?
Yeah, so if you're looking at statistics, right, and you're looking at the likelihood of a trans woman of color holding a career job, you know, that plays out to exactly what you said. I think 15 cents per dollar compared to a cis white man, you know, and even for a cis white woman, it's 75 cents
right.
for every dollar a man makes. For a cis woman of color, depending on the ethnicity, that changes. So for example, a cis black woman makes about 55 cents on the dollar. A cis Latino woman makes around 50 cents. And a cis Native American woman makes even less than that. So now you're adding an additional factor of oppression onto it and lower employment likelihoods, and it just becomes the reality. For cis white women, I think it's like 35 cents on average. For cis women of color, it's around 15 cents, and that seems to be pretty uniform, at least from what I know about ethnic situations when they're in play in employment situations, so...
I mean, and also, there's the obvious, trans people are much higher likely to commit suicide when they're yes. young, so they never even make it to mm-hmm. ever getting a career or ever being able to have any chance of thriving in this stupid capitalist society.
Absolutely. No, and I think what gets me, too, is I hear that a lot. It's like, why should we really care about trans people when they're either just going to kill themselves and... Also,
you've heard people say that?
Yes, I have heard people say that, and I've also heard people talk about, like, oh, we shouldn't necessarily allow for gender transition because it's clearly a mental illness. And it's like, no, gender dysphoria is obviously a situation in the brain, but it's more about your brain not matching with your body, and the mental illness comes with the discomfort from that, right? First of all, you don't have to be dysphoric to be transgender, right? That doesn't have to happen. You don't have to feel dysphoria to be trans. You know, clinically, a lot of institutions might prevent you from getting access to hormones if you don't at least have some form of recognizable dysphoria to them, right? But that's another barrier to, like, trans healthcare that I'll probably talk about later. But what's the problem for a lot of trans people really is just, you know, stop, like, attacking us for who we are, you know, and we'll stop killing ourselves. Like, the rate of suicide returns to normal levels if the trans person is raised in a loving home, is surrounded by friends and family that, you know, nurture and care and support and recognize the person for the gender that they are and recognize the issues that they deal with and don't exacerbate them, you know? And so it's like, just be fucking nice to us and you'll start seeing suicide levels return to normal. I mean, if you put someone in a position where they're constantly called stupid or they're constantly called horrible, like, degrading names, you know, it's going to be like, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to start internalizing all of it, and it's just going to be really bad, right?
Right. It seems like a pretty obvious cycle, but some people don't seem to get that.
No, I mean,
you're hated on by people, then that's going to have an effect on your mental health.
It's not even if you're hated on by people, because I think, like, everybody to some degree deals with some form of hatred, right? With the exception of white men, right? Their hatred is perceived, not actual. But, you know, it's not even about that. It's like there's no refuge from it. That there's literally no place where people can go and be separated from the violence and the hatred. You know, I walk out and I don't necessarily conform to even gender roles that are expected for me as a trans woman. Like, you know, I dress more like center of the spectrum. I'm sort of like a center mask, center femme, depending on how lazy or not lazy that I'm feeling in the morning.
Right, but that's just extra societal pressure.
Exactly.
Like, you're dressed exactly like I am right now.
Right.
You're wearing a t-shirt, a pair of jeans.
Yep.
Like, we're dressed exactly the same. And no one's going to question how I'm performing femininity.
Exactly. Right, because they recognize your, for lack of a better way of putting it, cisness, right? But for me, it's like, and I'm fortunate enough to where I have certain features that don't necessarily make me easier to clock, but then I also have some that do. You know, I've got a much more square jaw in comparison, you know.
But you have very pretty hair.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I spend about $300 a month on it. Every 6 months. So, you know, I feel like it better be looking good. Otherwise, I'm wasting my money here. But, you know, it's like that perception of following gendered expectations doesn't affect cis people the same way, because the most that the cis person is going to get for not following a particular set of expectations for their gender identity and their gender expression is maybe a word or two.
Right. You know? Maybe you'll get called a tomboy when you're
right.
A kid.
But
there is some weirdness with that, though. Of
yes.
Having to perform femininity to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm speaking at an event or to a board of people, I wear makeup.
Yeah.
I wear a dress. This, you know, it's a mask women do put on, and it's even more so that you have to put this mask on if you're a trans woman.
Exactly, because the consequences of not performing to your gender identity if you are a trans woman is
It's
almost certainly fatal, you know. And even when you do, if somebody recognizes you as pretending, even though you're not, pretending to be the gender that you say that you are, also the consequences are deadly. So, for example, I was in college in San Diego, and I was in downtown, and I took the public transit, so they have, like, trams and, like, trains, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, that go across different places in San Diego, and I was meeting some friends at the gas lamp, and I had taken the tram into one of the stations nearby, and I had a really great night with my friends. Nothing happened at the bar that we were at, right? But when I left the bar and got on public transit, you know, I was the only one in this train car for a while, and then after a certain stop, these guys got on the train, and one of them started looking at me and, you know, started whispering things, and I had my headphones in, but I could see that he was talking to his friends. And then I'm on my phone, I'm just like on Reddit or something, I don't exactly remember what I was doing, but I look up at a certain point, and then all of them were surrounding me.
Oh no.
And, you know, so it's like, what's happening? And they start, one of the dudes just like yanks the headphones out of my ear and starts saying like every slur in the book, like asking me all these questions, you know, talking about what I have in my pants, you know, like that kind of thing, and just incredibly invasive. And then one of the other dudes has like a switchblade in his hand, and so it's like, okay, I don't really know what's going on. And literally the only thing that saved me in that moment, at least to my knowledge, I have no idea if these guys were actually intent on doing anything or were just using it as intimidation, but one of the only things that like saved me was somebody else got on the train.
Wow.
You know, like, we
had that's pulled, gotta be terrifying.
We had pulled into a station and literally some, like, other people got on the train. And it's like, that was it. You know, if we weren't pulling into another station and other people weren't
right,
getting on the train.
Right, who knows what could have happened.
Exactly, you know.
You might not be here with me drinking seven and seven.
No. You know, and I think about that a lot. But at the same time, I don't really want to let that, like, right. affect me, you know. Fuck those people, but at the same time, you know, I'd be remiss to say, if, to some degree, it isn't a constant reminder of the consequences of just trying to live. Like, literally just trying to do day-to-day things. Like, I literally was doing what most people do, which is when they're going home from a night out with their friends, and then it's like, bam, you know, something happens. And that's everything. It's going to the grocery store. It's just functioning. It's not even about, like, going out at a late night or anything like that. I was on that trolley car at, like, 6.
Well, you know? Even so if you had been out at a late at like 9, that's kind of like victim-blaming women who get raped. Like, what were you wearing?
Right, and exactly.
It's just this ridiculousness of you should be able to exist and live your life the same as anyone else mm-hmm. should be able to exist and live their life.
Yep.
It's not that hard of a request, guys. It's not that big of an ask.
It's not a big fucking deal. It's pretty simple. I mean, let people live. I mean, I try to live by that philosophy for pretty much most of my life, but, you know.
And I know we wanted to get onto some other issues as well, but mm-hmm. one last thing when we're talking about transgender rights was something else that you had mentioned at the Women's Forum was that someone who's a trans man may still have the possibilities of getting pregnant.
Yep.
And often are not allowed into abortion spaces.
Yeah. So, I don't know how this is everywhere, but I know that I've heard stories from trans men in California who have not necessarily been able to access certain women's-only spaces, like an abortion clinic or anything like that, for, like, obvious reasons. Like, they're men, and this is supposed to be a safe place for women, but at the same time, trans men, a lot of them still have the capabilities of getting pregnant, right? And so, what I talk about a lot, too, is making sure that abortion clinics and abortion providers are not only well-versed in trans issues, but also allow space for trans men and other people who can get pregnant to access those services, because if you're a masculine identified person who has the capability of getting pregnant and you don't want to be pregnant for obvious reasons, you know, not being able
to access those services,
terminate yeah. the pregnancy, you know, is incredibly harmful, not only to the person's gender identity and the person's sense of self, but also think about from the perspective of, like, let's say they have to carry that baby to term. You know, like, that's not a child that's going to be raised in a situation where they're going to experience a positive upbringing. I mean, by definition, the person who was pregnant did not want them, you know? And that's the case for a lot of cis women, right, who don't have access to these services. So now imagine a trans man who's a man who right. does not want to get pregnant, for whatever reason, ends up being pregnant, and it's a whole host of issues that doesn't really get talked about.
Yeah, it's not something I'd ever thought of until you mentioned it. I'm always, you know, I'm a big proponent of a woman's right to choose, and then when you have to take a step back, you're like, right, and a trans man's right to choose.
Well, like, see, it's just reproductive rights access. Right. I mean, in the general umbrella of it all, right? You know, people should have realistic and free access to prophylactics, birth control, sexual health, that kind of thing. You know, these are all things that people should not have to pay for. Healthcare in general is something that people should not have to pay for.
Well, obviously, we're both socialists, so right. We both don't pay
But, you know, when we exist in a society where it's about access and affordability, you know, affordability notwithstanding, and we're just left with that access question. You know, trans men don't necessarily face the same economic issues that other trans people face, but they still have some problems getting into the job market, that kind of thing. It's just not as near as bad as trans women, without sounding like I'm playing the oppression Olympics here. But
oppression Olympics.
I mean, yes, it's you know, I'm not trying to say that like my oppression is any bad or worse than anybody else's oppression. The point they want to make in talking about trans issues is that trans women and just trans people in general, whether they're non-binary, genderqueer, or on that trans spectrum in that binary, you know, there is not any discourse coming from prominent people on the left about this. It's almost sort of unilaterally assumed that trans people and their rights will just be included in any sort of liberation. And if you talk to, like, queer people, not even just trans people, if you talk to queer people in general, historically that has not been the case. Historically, leftist movements that have achieved sort of status and recognized as a form of a government in certain countries, they have not exactly been the beneficiaries of socialist policy.
Right, yeah.
You know, so for a lot of leftists, especially today, whether you're in DSA or another organization, you know, like, you as a cis person, you know, need to make sure that trans people and their rights are discussed. You know, because the onus, a lot of the times, what I've been told is, like, the onus is on trans people to bring it up all the time. And it's like, I'd like to be something other than this.
Right.
You know, I'd like to talk about something other than this. I'd like to talk about theory. I'd like to talk about what I think is a good economic perspective from Marxists or socialists to take, right? But I can't do that if I have to worry about all this other shit.
Right.
You know, like, I just like to function as a normal human being. I'd like my gender to be secondary. Like, so many liberal cis women have the, you know, capabilities of doing, you know, these Meghan McArdle types or, you know, Hillary Clinton. They don't necessarily have to think about their gender, and when they do think about their gender, it's almost usually used as a deflection of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
You're only criticizing me because I'm a woman and not because my policies are fucking shit. You know, like, that kind of thing, or the Bernie bro critique, right? I mean, that's where liberal feminism is heading, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's this identity is no longer a subject of liberation. It's a subject of how can I use my identity to deflect from criticism, right?
Right, which is the identity politics, the problems with identity politics.
Right, absolutely. And problems with liberal conceptualization of identity politics. I think socialists have a much better interpretation of identity politics and identity and how it relates to class because of the nature of solidarity, right? But at the same time, solidarity has not included queer people. It has not included trans people, right? So I'd like it, and I'm sure several other trans people in the socialist movement today would appreciate the agency that comes with being cis being used to sort of lift them up,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead of the sort of laissez-faire, hands-off, like, oh, we'll get to you kind of socialism that they've seen really prominently. Like, you know, what I think about big names and leftist quote-unquote media, right? And whether or not you think they're problematic or not, like the guys at Chapo, you know, like they're pretty big. You know, Current Affairs, they're also pretty big. Citations Needed. Like, I have yet to hear any substantive trans discourse. I dropped my phone. Excuse me.
Getting passionate about things.
I have yet to hear like any substantive discourse about trans issues or even queer issues from any of these people. And yes, a lot of these people, if not most of them, if not even all of them, are not queer, right? And
you're hopefully setting the trend here today.
Absolutely.
You're going on leftist media and openly we're having a conversation and starting a conversation about trans issues.
And my point, though, is that I shouldn't have to do this.
No.
You know, I shouldn't have to be like, okay, I'm a trans person. Somebody invite me on their show so somebody can feel like...
Right, you're still having power taken from you. That you had to wait for an invitation to come on a show to ask people to, like, you know, not treat you like shit.
And And I talk to people about this and their first thing is like, okay, why don't you start your own thing? And it's like the ignorance of that, like the economic ability for me to access starting my own podcast or YouTube channel or anything that may be the case. It's like you sit there and tell me you're familiar about like economic discourse on trans issues, and then it's like, but here, go ahead and just buy all this stuff with all the money you don't have and start a podcast. And it's like,
right,
that is A severely just like, we'll just call it a hot take. We'll just call it a hot take. I mean, that's what it is. It's
not.
I'm woke, but also stop bothering me.
Yeah, that happens.
It's performative. It's not, they don't, I worry a lot about it, you know, and I feel like a part of me is like, okay, I want to advocate for these issues, you know, and they need to be advocated for. But if I keep advocating for them, am I going to, like, make them less palatable? And I think that's a question that a lot of people who are activists face.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's hard to separate your personality from the activism that you do because your personality informs how you go about it, at least I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, if your personality can possibly be grating, if your passion can possibly be grating or even annoying, you know, like, the anxiety can be kind of overwhelming, you know?
I think that's a human experience.
Absolutely.
I don't think that has anything to do. But you had, as you said, you want to advocate for other stuff other than...
Yes.
You want to be something other than just a trans woman.
Yes.
And you are currently getting your master's in Holocaust and Genocide, correct?
Yes. For identity purposes, I'm not going to say where, but... I am getting my master's in Holocaust and Genocide Studies and talk about something that they think needs to be discussed on the left. It's like adequate foreign policy, but also what we do about the problem of mass violence. You know, I think I would be remiss to say that there aren't a lot of problems with how we deal with like intervention and how we deal with like sending people overseas to stop a genocide, right? And the consequences may be colonialist in the outcome of that. So I think it's about building something where we don't necessarily have to exist on that imperialist or colonialist paradigm, because as far as I know, and really the only thing that I can think about, right, intervention seems to be the only like viable way that we have of stopping a genocide, right? Historically, we've tried talking this out. We've tried, like, hey, stop killing these people. And it's like...
Right.
They don't do it, obviously. They either don't do it or they deny it, you know? And you know, it's like rethinking sovereignty for the modern age, you know? Because all this sort of exists on this, like, Westphalian sort of doctrine. Like, we have state sovereignty. You can't come in our state to stop us because... we have sovereignty, right? To do so would be illegal and also an act of war, right? And it's like, okay, you know, something like, okay, you know, we have to choose between letting potentially millions of people die or, you know, the legacy of imperialism and colonialism from the United States or from a Western European country. Right, or even an Eastern European country, like if Russia got involved. Russia has a history of imperialism too. Let's not pretend that they don't. You know, even under the Soviet Union, they absolutely did. There's this thing called Afghanistan. You know, but...
Right, so your thoughts are that we need to come at this from a different angle.
Absolutely.
That it's not... You can only have one or the other. You can avoid imperialism and still do good on the world scale.
Yes, and I think it involves... what a lot of people on the left are already doing, which is promoting a socialist government, right? Because a socialist government, by design, would not want to be imperialist, assuming that the people who are in charge of maintaining that government are held accountable by their citizens. So I'm not talking about, like, the Soviet-style sort of authoritarianism where the parliament really chooses who's the president or the premier of the Soviet Union, and then there's really no oversight to that. I'm talking about building a socialist democratic system that was intended, which is people have the right to choose their representation, and they have the ability to recall that representation at any time if they feel like, you know, they're going down the wrong path. Exactly. You know, the threat of a popular uprising against you and the ability for people to either vote you out or by other means, like, should serve as a pretty good check. I recognize that my position on intervention is not, like, exactly welcome in leftist circles, and I think, you know...
No, even before, we were discussing this before the show, and as soon as you said, you know, I want to remove the stigma of interventionism,
right.
And my first question was, well, how do you deal with the imperialism aspect?
Exactly.
And, but there is I think I said before, it's almost like a dance we can do of mm-hmm. how we can actually serve mankind and not be this classical exploitative, you know?
Right.
We're not going into a country thinking, what can we take?
And it's not necessarily even that. It's like not choosing to help people based on what we can take. Like, you know, when NATO got involved in Bosnia, right? Part of it was because they saw that region as, like, an effective countermeasure to Russia. Like, the whole purpose of NATO is to defend against Russian aggression, right? It's a Cold War relic, and so they bombed Bosnia, right? Killed a bunch of people, killed a bunch of innocent people, but, you know, they effectively ended the genocide, right? I'm not excusing that. They could have gone about that a lot better. In fact, I think the Bosnian genocide was handled completely incorrectly. But, you know, take that case, for example, and then take Rwanda. Okay, so if you take Rwanda, for example, that was a situation that could easily been prevented. Like, just the whole of it. The shooting down of Raul Habyarimana's plane, you know, all of it could have easily have been prevented if certain things don't happen. If the French don't do the really stupid fucking thing and send just 500,000 machetes, you know, to Rwanda. And I have studied the Rwandan genocide. I still don't know exactly why they did that. But, you know, I mean, a lot of these genocides can be explained by the legacy of, like, Western imperialism. You know, the Belgians were prominent in that region, and so the ethnic lines that were used in the Rwandan genocide, the Hutus and the Tutsis, they are a Belgian invention. They, at least in the manifestation of it as it existed in the Rwandan genocide, they may have had those ethnic identities prior to that, but they weren't delineated in the way that they were until the Belgians got there.
They came in and imposed these identities on
right.
people.
You know,
as a way of dividing. And,
absolutely.
Which is a lot of what capitalism and
exactly,
colonialism, that's
right.
kind of the goal of capitalism and colonialism.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the UN sent General Romeo Dallaire to Rwanda. And all they gave Dallaire to inform himself on the situation in Rwanda was an Encyclopedia Britannica page.
Really?
Yes. They literally gave him a page out of Encyclopedia Britannica about Rwanda.
Here you go.
That was it. That's all they sent him in there. And he had the ability to destroy a weapons cache. And we don't necessarily know the consequences of what would have happened if he would have been allowed to destroy the weapons cache, but I would imagine that the ability for the Hutu extremists to commit the atrocities that they did would have been at least severely limited. Because from what I know, this was a really extensive weapons cache. This was a huge weapons cache, you know? And also, if the Belgians didn't pull out, which was the whole goal of the Hutu extremists in killing the Belgian UN soldiers was to get the Belgians to leave. Because they knew that if the white man left, they'd basically have free reign to do whatever they wanted. Right? You know, and it wasn't until Paul Kagame and the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, came in and actually stormed Kigali and took over capital, and where he reigns to this day, you know, and he's got his own host of problems, you know. If the United Nations had just listened to Romeo Dallaire and sent him the additional troops, they wouldn't have had to fire a single shot. They could have effectively stopped the genocide before it even started. And we wouldn't necessarily be having the conversation about 800,000 Rwandans being killed. Because he would have forced Hutu extremists into a position where they don't have the ability to do the things that they want to
do.
You know, you can certainly make an argument that that would have just delayed the inevitable. Like, the Hutu extremists would have just not negotiated and then they would have been in a stalemate for all time. I recognize that. But we have to ask ourselves, like, is that better than 800,000?
Right, we know the outcome we got was a bad one. You know, we can't necessarily.
So I think, and I think it is, because I think, you know, we have to rationalize that being anti-war means finding other ways to resolve conflict. And one of those ways that we resolve conflict is diplomacy.
Right.
No.
And that's kind of not what we do nowadays.
No, we're not, we don't. There really isn't, at least to my knowledge, a substantive discourse on consistent foreign policy on the left besides being like anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist. I'm like, that's fine, right? But that's not overarching foreign policy.
Right. You know? There needs to be more than just we're against imperialism.
Right.
Which obviously we're against imperialism. It's the whole toll of badness, but you know, mm-hmm. we need more substance on the left.
Exactly.
And we need to have solutions. So I mean, I think that even if you are met with some resistance, it's conversations that are worth having.
Yes. And I think right now interventionism is the only real paradigm that we have to save people's lives. And I'm not talking about like this Iraq war bullshit. You know, like, where they plagiarized one of my professor's papers, which they did, and used that as justification for Iraq having WMDs and going and invading us, starting a, you know, 15-year-long quagmire plus into the Middle East. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a situation where we have a credible threat of where oppressed people, ethnic minorities, religious, cultural, sexual, gender minorities, are being threatened with extermination, just because of who they are. I think as leftists and just as people, we have a responsibility to prevent that. And that means using violence, so to speak, if we have to. Because if we recognize in our own society, right, that the state is a means of violence, and there are some on the left who believe that the way to overthrow that is through a violent resistance and revolution, right? So it's simply about taking that logic and applying it to a global scale.
Right.
You know, we have a dictator, a fascist, or whoever it is that is literally killing people because of who they are. We have a responsibility to stop that, however that looks. But we have a responsibility to prevent that from happening, you know, and not only from a moral perspective, but I think a political perspective too, and I don't think that's inconsistent with leftist discourse. How we go about it is obvious where there's going to be some discourse. But
everything we've done up until this point is looking at it through this lens of capitalism and how are we utilizing this to exploit the people and make money for the capitalist class.
Right.
So if we're looking at it from a different point of view, we'll have to come up with different solutions than what we've done up until this point. And I think all solutions should be discussed, or at least all reasonable solutions should be discussed.
Exactly.
I'm not one of those people that believe, oh, we've got to listen to the Nazis. No, you punch Nazis.
No, you don't just punch Nazis, but yeah.
Right. So, but if it's coming from a non-capitalist thing, then we need to discuss what that diplomacy looks like. What does our role of international relations look like from mm-hmm. a non-capitalist perspective?
Exactly.
So yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing to think about, and you know, I think the people get very set into their ideologies, which is why I wouldn't say I'm a specific anything. I'm not a Maoist. I'm not a Marxist. I like to take a little bit from...
See, it's funny you say that, because I'm actually a transhumanist, and I mean this completely unironically, and I want to just be like a Wi-Fi-enabled toaster so I can like fuck with people and like print toast when they're least expecting it, you know? Like, I'm kidding, of course, but, you know, that's... No, I also want to talk to dolphins, so I guess I'm a posadist too. But, I
don't know. All kinds of interesting terms we're learning today here. Wine, women, and revolution. as the seven and sevens are flowing, now we're dolphin conversations. But really, it's been great having this talk with you here today.
Extremely online.
I'll give you the last word, though.
Okay. So you can go ahead if you want to. You can follow me on Twitter, like at leftistwriter. I just tell insurance companies to fuck off. So that's most of my Twitter. So if you're interested in seeing that, please, if you want some catharsis, please follow me on Twitter. Also, I am a member of South Jersey Democratic Socialists of America. So if you are in the area and you want to get involved, please feel free to talk to the Facebook page and they will get you situated. But, you know, also, if you are...
And I think it's worth noting that your chapter of DSA is not the same thing as what's going on in New York right now. You know, you're very different. There's some really good comrades in your particular chapter of
we're
DSA.
We are a very tight-knit group. I mean, I've had a lot of people in DSA here check in with me, trying to make sure that everything that they've had has been going well and that I'm in a comfortable position, you know, they're just trying to help me out. And I think because of how tight-knit everything is, I think we have the capacity for some real positive work. You know, when you're surrounded by people who are all just as equally committed as you are to justice and to equity and just, like, advocating
for... And you're not shilling for the Democrats.
No,
that
I am
not
shilling for the Democrats.
At all.
No, I voted for Democrats and... That was a mistake.
You kind of need a shower after you do that.
Yeah.
Right? You feel dirty.
You know, so the last thing they want to say too is if you are in a position where you have the ability to choose who gets hired and who doesn't, you know, like try your best to hire trans people. If any trans people have applied or you've interviewed any trans people, like, use your agency to help bring trans people into the workforce. It's not something that you necessarily, like, have the responsibility to do, but I think from a moral perspective, it's the right thing to do. Because the alternative for a lot of trans people, again, going back to this, is something far worse than, you know...
Until we overthrow capitalism, we can try to make it at least as kind to everyone as... Mm-hmm.
And also, if you are involved in any leftist organizing, or even if you're by any chance a liberal listening to this, you know, talk about trans issues. Allow trans women in the spaces where they can speak about these issues. Use your agency to help advocate for trans people. If that means speaking on behalf of trans people, or if that means letting somebody come into a city council meeting that you got invited to, you know, and speak about trans issues at that city council meeting. You know, these kinds of things, every single little bit helps. And I know we're sort of like hung up on the slow game here, and the concept of, like, incrementalism, right? Yeah, Democratic Party incrementalism is shit, right? But what I'm talking about is every little slow thing that you do to help lift trans women and trans people, particularly trans people of color, up, is a step in the right direction. And I would wager that most trans people, although we really desperately want full equity, like, right this fucking second, you know, I think in comparison to what we have now, somebody doing some basic advocacy work on behalf of us instead of leaving us to do it and having us be so fucking exhausted all the time would be a huge relief. because I'm tired of having to, like, petition for these issues to be discussed. And I get why people in larger discourse on the left are, like, hesitant to want to talk about these issues because of the sort of body politic around saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, right? Well, it's about, you know, being open to criticism, being open to changing your perspective, and continuing to get better. I mean, as leftists, that's what we do. We continually find ways to advocate and to help uplift others, right? So just take that philosophy, which is already sort of internal to what you believe in, and now apply it to trans people. And I think in doing that, we can help create a much better society for everybody, not just trans people.
I think that was beautifully said. Thanks. I think that was spot on perfect what you just said there. To my listeners, thank you for joining us tonight. And as we always, I hate to keep asking, but we need your help. Costs us about $25 a week. My partner did the math for us, so I don't have to do that, to keep this show on the air or to keep our network going for another week. It's not a huge amount, but it's right now, no one's getting paid. It's all coming out of our pockets. So we need donors. We need subscribers, monthly subscribers. We have a Patreon for $10 a month. You're a comrade of the show. You get some special insider stuff. We mention your name. We thank you personally. You know, on up to if your organization wants to be a sponsor, you can have us come out and interview you once a month to get out your message. Whatever it is, we're trying to elevate the activist community and be a voice and help get these messages and cover the stories no one else is. So if you guys like that, then you need to help us out. And we thank you so much for listening. You can find us anywhere that you can find podcasts now. We are now officially on iTunes as well. It took us a while, but we're there. And thank you guys so much. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.